Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide daily over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, business, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on lying deceivers when we come back. You know, when people call the law school, they often ask me how they can learn more about the topics that I speak on over the air. Well, keep in mind that most of these topics that you hear on the radio, we teach in detail here in one of my classes here at the law school. Now, for example, when you hear me talking about the common law, it was Alfred the Great that codified the common law in 872 AD into 49 principles or statutes, of which 22 have been incorporated into our federal constitution and Bill of Rights. Now, the common law was taken from the Mosaic law given to Moses at Mount Sinai. It was recorded in Exodus 19, verse 16, through Exodus 24, verse 8, and it includes negligence, insurance, and taxes such as income, property, and social security taxes. Now, you know, these IRS taxes are a counterfeit of the tithing laws in Scripture, and they work a theft on everyone that participates in them. Now, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob gave us a better way of life than income tax and Social Security, and that's the basis of our tax and status school. You know, we owe this income tax and Social Security tax because we've contracted into it. Now, if you'd like to learn more about tax and status, why don't you write for our free general law CD package first? That's the place to start. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining, and best of all, it's free, and you can call and order one right now. The number's 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, click onto the archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package right there. Once more, that's georgegordon.org, and go to the archives page. You know, one of the interesting things that I find about my job is that I get to research and look up all kinds of lying deceptions. It's a part and parcel of our business, uncovering what somebody has said or what somebody has done, some kind of a deception that's going on. And there's a book out here. It was written by David Barton some years back now. It's called America to Pray or Not to Pray. And the theme of the book has to do with the taking of morality, the taking of prayer out of the public schools, the taking of morality out of the public school. And they claim that they did this because it was constitutionally required. And there's been a result. There's been a conclusion to the whole matter. And David Barton wrote this book, and he points out the conclusion in our public schools to the taking of prayer and morality out of the public schools has been an unmitigated disaster. It has created a rate of 25% of the young people now going to our public schools have STDs, sexually transmitted diseases. The reason for putting sex education in public school, by the way, was so that we could eradicate or seriously bring down the rate of premarital pregnancies in public school. And exactly the opposite has occurred. You see, premarital pregnancy in public school today affects 10% of the students. I'm guessing that it's 10% of the whole student body, which only 50% are female, but it takes two to tango, you know what I mean? So since it takes two to tango and the rate's 10%, you've got unwed, unmarried female mothers, but you got these unwed male fathers. You know, just the way life is, takes two to tango. Now, when I was a kid, when they came to us about 1960 and said we need the sex education in public school, the public school system in America is accepted as if we invented it. But our Constitution doesn't say a word about public school. None of the signers to the Constitution or the Declaration of Independence ever went to public school. Public schools didn't exist. They got their start in Massachusetts in 1838. Today they're common, probably around 85 to 87% of American children now go to public school. Only about 12 or 13% go to homeschool or private school. And the private schools, for all intents and purposes, are public schools insofar as curriculum is concerned, although the church schools and so on, you know, they've got a little more latitude in teaching morality. But there's a section that deals with this thing of morality in America to Pray or Not to Pray. And I thought I'd bring it to your attention because the concept that morality could be legislated or could be taught in public school is a lying deception. It's a fiction. We have classes in which we state that our goal is morality or we want to put an end to premarital pregnancy. Now, I wouldn't go so far as to say the real agenda was to create more premarital pregnancy. I don't know that that's the case, but that's been the result. Now, we send our children to public school, and we are told that our children are our future, and we need to do this to educate them. There has never been a time in American history when the children coming out of these public schools have been any dumber, any more ignorant. You are living in the era of the dumbest student that God has ever put breath into coming out of America's public schools today. The dropout rate is right at 50%. I think that the graduation rate nationwide is out around 65%, something on that order. Not that necessarily means you're dumb. My grandmother did not graduate from high school, neither did my granddad, but I'll venture a guess that there isn't a one of you listening to me today that could write as well as my grandmother. I mean, her handwriting was like Thomas Jefferson's. And while she only went to the eighth grade, she graduated from the eighth grade, and I'll bet you there's not a one of you college graduates out there, not a one, that could pass that 1895 test that came out of Kansas that I've reported on a time or two. And that might be a little bit of an exaggeration. You know, there might be a couple of you that could pass it, but by and large, the rest of us couldn't. So let's take a look at some of this deception that goes on in our public school system, shall we? Barton starts off, he says, George Washington, in his farewell address, perhaps the most significant political speech ever delivered by a U.S. president, warned the nation in these words. He said, "Let us with caution indulge the supposition that morality may be maintained without religion. Whatever may be conceded to the influence of refined education on minds, reason and experience both forbid us to expect that national morality can prevail in exclusion of religious principle." So here's your first president of the United States. He says religion is absolutely indispensable to morality. Morality is absolutely indispensable to Republican government. And that's because we expect people to be responsible. I'm not so sure that people are responsible now today. People who are on Social Security are not responsible for their old age. Government is, as is evidenced by the fact that these people are on the dole. You got 40 million people who are on food stamps. Obviously, those people are not responsible for supporting themselves because they can't. So, you know, I'll just leave it to you. You can figure it out for yourself. We're talking about morality here, but I mean, the sages of the past, our founding fathers, they all believed that responsibility at the individual level and morality was absolutely essential to the well-being of the nation. Now, we've abandoned morality and individual responsibility. I'll take a look at where we're at in the global financial crisis, and you can answer the question for yourself. Is America viable for the next 100 years? And I don't believe it for a minute. It is true that Americans will be here, I presume, for the next 100 years. There have been some cases where people have been forcibly deported from their native lands. That's an old practice, went back into ancient times. But, you know, as a general rule, when a nation collapses or their economy collapses, like Argentina did in 2002, you know, you don't deport all the people. The people in Argentina are still there. Germany lost World War II, but the German people are still sitting there in Germany. But their government is radically changed, and their economy has radically changed. You know, everything about Germany prior to World War II and compared to today has radically changed from what it was. There'll be some radical changes here in the United States, but, you know, by and large, we'll all be here. Now, he goes on to point out that Washington's statement was not a radical new teaching. It was the articulation of a fundamental and commonly held belief of the founders. Not merely reason, but experience had proven that morality could not be maintained if separated from religious principles. This was also the unquestioned and unalterable stand in the Supreme Court rulings for 170 years, until the court arbitrarily rejected these standards in 1962. Now, so completely have religious principles been expunged from education that in 1981, a court ruled on a legal challenge against teaching premarital sexual abstinence to students in the public school. So let's notice some excerpts from the court's decision. "The harm of premarital sexual relations are fundamental elements of religious doctrine. It is a fundamental tenet of many religions that premarital sex is wrong. In short, the program teaching premarital sexual abstinence has the primary effect of advancing religion. This alone would force the court to declare the law constitutionally infirm. The inescapable conclusion is that federal funds have been used to teach matters that are inherently tied to religion," said the court in Kendrick versus Bowen. Now, although this case was eventually modified by the Supreme Court in 1988, the fact that it even reached that court and that it took 7 years to reach a partial resolution shows the extent to which basic moral values have been rejected under the new interpretation of separation of church and state. In 1988, California was considering adopting legislation on the sex education for public schools, requiring that the course material and instruction shall stress the monogamous heterosexual intercourse, one man and one woman, within marriage is a traditional American value. Well, the senator promoting the bill received a letter of protest from the ACLU, dated April 18, 1988, and they said, it is our position that monogamous heterosexual intercourse within marriage is a traditional American value as an unconstitutional establishment of a religious doctrine in public school. And there are various religions which hold contrary beliefs with respect to marriage and monogamy. We believe this bill violates the First Amendment. Now, students across the nation are being provided with materials in their sex education classes from groups like Planned Parenthood, materials containing photographs, illustrations, and graphics encouraging and demonstrating premarital sexual relations for adolescents. Now, consider these very mild excerpts from books and materials that Planned Parenthood and similar other groups recommend for adolescents in public school. This one is entitled Boys and Sex. It says, more and more people are coming to understand that having sex is a joyful and enriching experience at any age, page 2. Playing with girls sexually before adolescence increases the chances for a satisfactory sex life when a boy grows up, page 38. Premarital intercourse does have its definite values as a training ground for marriage. Boys and girls who start having intercourse when they're adolescents will find that it is a big help. It's like taking a car out on a test run before you buy it. Page 117. Now, in the section on girls and sex, it says, girls understand now that they are far more likely to make good sexual and social adjustments to life if they learn to be warm, open, responsive, and sexually unafraid. They're learning to be sexual partners of men. Page 10 and 11. Everyone is agreed that teenage sex should be a learning experience. Page 15. Sex play with boys can be exciting, pleasurable, and even worthwhile. It will later help sexual adjustment, on page 48. You've changed the combination. There are only two basic kinds of sex, sex with victims and sex without. Sex with victims is always wrong. Sex without is always right. One way to avoid having victims is, of course, to have sexual relationships only with your friends. And then there's the great orgasm robbery. Sex is fun and joyful, and it comes in all types and styles, all of which are okay. Do what gives pleasure and enjoy what gives pleasure and ask for what gives pleasure. Don't rob yourself of joy by focusing on old-fashioned ideas about what's normal or nice. And the effect that these school sex ed curriculums have had on the nation since the rejection of religious principles is now very apparent. By prohibiting student access to religious principles, the court has prohibited student access to the principles which produce morality. On the following graphs, notice the unusually strong correlation between the court's decisions to prohibit student access to religious principles while at school and the dramatic changes in student morality. And now he follows here with a number of graphs. You can't see them, and I'm not going to describe them, but I wanted to read that to you. That's what's being taught in your public schools, taught by teachers, people that went to college and have degrees after their name. Now, of course, God in the Bible comes down with a law that says, thou shalt not commit adultery. And we say, no, God, you're wrong. You're wrong. There's a lot of other religions out there that believe in adultery, practice adultery, and those religion and religious people, they're members of the American community. So in our public schools, we can't teach these biblical principles. We can teach satanic principles. We can teach other religious principles, but we can't teach the Hebrew biblical principles. Well, now, you know, these are decisions that people have to make, and we've made them. And now we've got results, and now, you know, you and I are living with these results, and these results are very expensive. You take a 14-year-old girl, gets knocked up and has a baby, and if she wants to continue with her education, then we have to provide these daycare centers in these public schools that all cost us taxpayers a little more money. So morality, or the lack of morality in this case, costs us, the taxpaying public, a whole lot more money. These teenage mothers oftentimes don't finish high school, and then they end up on welfare and food stamps and so on. They end up on the dole. They have to be taken care of. They're not productive members of society. They have to be taken care of. Well, then that costs the rest of us a lot of our time, effort, and energy, doesn't it? Let's take 100 people. Let's think about this for a minute. Let's take 100 people and put us on an island. And we start off on the island with everybody on the island working. Everybody on the island builds a house. Everybody on the island has palm trees and coconut trees and banana trees, and everybody on the island builds a boat, and everybody on the island catches fish, and everybody on the island produces 100% of everything that he consumes. Now that's a pretty prosperous island. Everybody is 100% self-sufficient, and in fact, if they went ahead and they wanted to do some trading, you might even find that somebody on the island maybe would start making paper and writing books, which might make life a little bit more advanced for us. And somebody on the island might start making jewelry out of seashells or something so we could wear adornments and so on. All right, so now we got 100 people on the island. 100 people are 100% self-sufficient. One day, old Bob falls out of a coconut tree and breaks his back. And the 99 of us look over here at old Bob and we say, oh my God, old Bob broke his back. Now Bob is unable to climb the coconut tree, unable to gather his bananas, unable to fish. So the rest of us on the island, we get together and we say, well, it's unfortunate that Bob fell out of the tree and broke his back and is now 100% disabled and unable to take care of himself. But after all, there's 99 of us here. And the 99 of us here are able to feed ourselves and take care of ourselves, and it wouldn't take very much more. You know, just one coconut, just one banana, just one fish every day from each one of us would more than take care of Bob. And so welfare is born on the island, and we have 99 producers, and we have one non-producer who is living off of the other 99, and it's not a great burden. And then one day, Joe falls out of a coconut tree. He too now has a broken back, and he's unable to take care of himself. But 98 people can take care of themselves, plus two who cannot. As this continues on, one day we wake up and we find that we have 90 producers and 10 that are unable to produce. So can 90 people take care of 10? Well, the answer is yes, yeah, yeah. But all of us now have 10% less. See, all of us, the 90 that are left, produce 100% for everything that we consume, plus we have to produce 10% more now for the 10 that don't produce for themselves. As this trend continues, it'll be 80-20. Can 80 people support 20? Yeah, yeah, they can. But they're going to live 20% poorer in the process. Their standard of living is going to be 20% less than it was when they were producing 100% and they got 100% of what they produced. How about 70-30? Yeah, yeah, that'll work. Yeah, we could do that. 70-30. How about 60-40? Yeah, that'll work. How about 50-50? Okay, now when we get down to 50% of the population is unable to produce anything for themselves, and they have to live off of the other half. That means that the half that are the producers must produce 100% of everything that they've produced in the past. Plus, they have to produce another 100% for the 50 guys that aren't producing anything. So every non-producer in the society, every non-producer, reduces the standard and quality of life for everybody that does produce. And at some point in time, we don't know where it's at, here in America, 51 people are taking some form of government assistance. And 49% of the people take no government assistance whatsoever. Now, that doesn't mean that the people, the 51% that are taking government assistance, are on 100% disability. That's not true. They're on various forms. It may be 5, 10, 20, 50, or 100% disability. But the point is, here in America, more than one half of us are taking money from the government. We're not producing 100%. We might be producing 60%, 50%, 40%, 30%, but we're not producing 100. Now, at some point in time, the 50 who are producing are going to say, I'm getting tired of this and I don't want to do it anymore, which is selfish on their part. I don't deny it. And the 50 who cannot produce for themselves through no fault of their own, you know, it just wasn't their fault they fell out of the coconut tree, but, you know, that's where reality is. So the more people you can have producing, the better your standard of living is going to be. And the fewer people that are producing, the poorer your standard of living is going to be. And that's where we're at today. We have a lot of people that don't produce. And yet we're being told, you know, Social Security will last forever. I covered that a little earlier on. That's a fiction. That isn't going to last. Medicare, that'll take care of the people who can't take care of themselves. It will, but not forever. And that's because it's growing faster than the people are producing to support it. So it's not going to last forever either. Now, it's not going to collapse tomorrow or next week or next month, But it's unsustainable the way it is, and if we continue on, the ultimate end to this is going to be all of us will starve to death. That's the ultimate end. So something's going to have to change. And of course, the sooner that it changes, the better. Maybe we should climb our coconut trees with a harness so that we can't fall out of them anymore. And that's a thought. But something here has to change. And it's not very likely that what's going on around us today is going to change very much. So there's a lot of lying deception going on that education is good for America, especially public education. And the answer to that is, no, it isn't. It's lacking in morality. There is an ultimate end to this. And the immorality will destroy the nation. It destroyed the Roman Empire. There were five causes to the destruction of the Roman Empire, Gibbons tells us, and Gibbons pointed out that their decline in religion and their immorality sunk their ship. Now, you can sit there and say, well, maybe it sunk the Roman ship, but it won't sink the American ship. Immorality has sunk every ship of state in every civilization going back 5,000 years without exception. Tell me the immoral state that survived and we still have today. Name one. Send me an email. I'd like to know about it. So my point is that it's a lying deception. Now, George Washington told us the truth when he said, you cannot divorce morality from religion. Now, we've divorced religion from our public schools. He said, you can't do that because you'll become immoral. And you can't divorce morality from our political state. We have, but I doubt if we're going back. And the results of that in the past has always been a disaster. So I thought I would report that to you. That's a lying deception. And the book you're looking for is America to Pray or Not to Pray. It's written by David Barton. There's probably 50 more of these lying deceivers exposed in a number of subjects and topics here in the book. I mean, this guy's got a wealth of information in here. And I won't cover it all because, you know, there's other things here that I wanted to cover in this series. But I just thought I'd bring this one on morality to your attention. Hey, we're at the halfway point here. I got to give you a reminder that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from a scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives. All of it can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. That's for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order one by calling and asking for it. The number's 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, go to our website, georgegordon.org. Click onto the archives page, and you can download it right there, georgegordon.org. The sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing will necessarily reciprocate. Now keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review either. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear in this program are mine, they're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call the law school direct at 417-273-4967. Hey, I got a book here that's going to blow your socks off. And there's a lying deception, not in the book, but about the book. It's called The Lost 10 Tribes of Israel Found. And it's in most people's mind, when they hear that, they say, oh my God, that's that pagan doctrine of British Israelism. But is it a pagan doctrine, British Israelism? Is that a false doctrine? Well, here in the toward the end of the book is a section that says the tribes of Israel in the modern world. So the guy's name now is Stephen M. Collins, The Lost 10 Tribes of Israel Found by Stephen M. Collins. And you can probably get a copy of the book. The publisher is called, see if I got the publisher here, Bible Blessings, I think it is. publishing company. Let me see if I'm right. No. This one here comes from CPA Book Publisher, P.O. Box 596, Boring, Oregon, 97009. And the phone number is 503-668-4977. Copyright 1992. It's 18 years old. First revised edition 1995. All rights reserved. Fourth printing in the United States by CPA Book Publisher. You can't get this book in the Bible bookstore. They won't hold it. They won't carry it. I was talking to this guy. I said, yeah, I tried to get my book into the Bible bookstores, and they won't take it. The Christian Bible bookstores will not take this book. Now, in the New Testament, you probably remember from Sunday school a statement where the Messiah, Jesus, he sent his disciples, he said, go not out of the way, but go to the lost sheep of Israel, of which there's 10 of these lost tribes. Well, now there's 12 tribes of Israel, remember 12, and out of these 12 tribes, 10 of them got lost. And generally speaking, in history, we don't know where they're at. Can't find them. They're gone. Lost. I just wanted to point out, that's a lying deception. All 12 tribes have been found. Published. And this is just one book out of many. I could point to a number of books. Well, let me start off. J. H. Allen, Judah's Scepter and Joseph's Birthright, that's one. The British Israel Society, number one, Buckingham Gate, London, that's two. Herbert Armstrong wrote a book called British Israel, or the United States and British Commonwealth in Prophecy. That's three. And this guy, Stephen Collins, he's written five books on the subject. This one is probably the preeminent publication, which has an actual chapter and identifies the exact country where these Israelite tribes that became lost after Nebuchadnezzar's sacking of Jerusalem in 586 B.C., where they are today, including the United States, Canada, Australia, Iceland, Greenland, France, Wales, England, Scotland, Ireland, Finland, Sweden, Norway, Luxembourg, France, Germany, Belgium, Denmark, Switzerland, did I say Germany, South Africa, New Zealand? I think that's just about all of them. About 20 countries around the world where these 10 tribes are located. So the next time you hear somebody tell you that this is British Israelism and that it's a false doctrine, don't you believe it. It's a lie. So I thought I'd read to you one or two sections out of here where it just takes a page or two. I think I can cover that. There's one here that deals with the tribe of Reuben, R-E-U-B-E-N. Reuben was the eldest son of Jacob, and we learn much about him in Genesis 37, verses 12 through 35. When the other sons of Jacob were intent on killing Joseph, Reuben intervened to prevent it. And the Bible relates that Reuben did not participate in selling Joseph into slavery either, but had intended to return Joseph to the safety of Jacob's custody. While this account shows good intentions on Reuben's part, it also shows one of his weak points. Now, although Reuben's goal of rescuing Joseph was good, he lacked the follow-through to implement this worthy goal. And one can only wonder why Reuben wandered away from an urgent crisis which required his full attention. Although Reuben was the oldest and did not participate in the plot against Joseph, he did join his brother's deception in telling Jacob that Joseph had been killed by a lion. Well, years later, when the brothers felt guilty about their misdeeds toward Joseph, Reuben chimed in with an I told you so comment in Genesis 42, verses 18 through 23. Now, this account confirms that while Reuben still recalled his good intentions, he never had the determination to act on those good intentions. The above accounts make it clear that Reuben had a tendency to cave in when pressured or intimidated. Reuben preferred to grudgingly coexist with something that he opposed, rather than confronting the evil all by himself. Reuben also had great physical appetites, and he had difficulty in controlling his sexual urges. In Genesis 35, verse 22, it tells us that Reuben had sex with Bilhah, his father's concubine, the mother of Reuben's own brothers, Dan and Naphtali. Now, we're not told how long Reuben's affair went on before Jacob learned about it, but it surely created severe stress in Jacob's family, as the firstborn Reuben would ordinarily have received the birthright promises. But in Genesis 49, verse 4, it indicates this inability to control his appetites caused the transfer of his birthright to Ephraim and Manasseh. Now, the Reubenites lived in Gilead with Gad and half of Manasseh east of the Jordan River, and they were carried into Asian captivity by the Assyrians years before the fall of Samaria that we read about in 2 Kings 10, verse 33. When Assyria's empire fell, many of the liberated Israelites migrated northward into southern Russia, and we have no specific word of the Reubenites after their exit from Palestine. However, as the seed of Isaac, they would have been one of the many Sakai or Saka tribes. When the Parthians and the Scythians were forced into Europe in search of new homelands, the Reubenites would have been present among the waves of Caucasian people who poured into Europe from Asia. To identify the Reubenites, we must rely upon the clues of the prophecy in Genesis 49, verses 3 and 4, about this tribe in the latter days, where it tells us that, quote, Reuben, you are my firstborn, preeminent in pride and preeminent in power, unstable as water. You shall not have preeminence because you went up to your father's bed, and then you defiled it, unquote. Well, several things are readily apparent. While Reuben will have pride and power in these latter days, it will not have preeminence over the other tribes of Israel because it had lost the birthright to Joseph. Reuben will also be a volatile, emotional people, unstable as water, is rendered boiling over like water, and unruly as the wild waves of the sea in the Amplified and Living versions of the Scripture. Since Reuben's lack of sexual restraint is again cited in this latter day, this will also be a characteristic of the Reubenites in the modern world. So what nation in modern Europe has substantial power and pride, but has less power than the English or the Americans, is volatile, emotional, and is famous for its physical and sexual appetites? Well, the nation which immediately comes to mind is France. After the English and Americans, the French are the next strongest nation in the Western Alliance. France became a populous nation and also had a substantial colonial empire of its own. The French are famous for their emotional volatility, and the term French leave is a euphemism for a hasty, unauthorized departure. Prior to 1958, the French exhibited profound instability in their nation, changing governments at an incredible rate. And the Encyclopedia Americana has noted that during the 70 years of the Third Republic, from 1875 to 1945, more than 100 cabinets succeeded one another in France, with an average tenure in office of less than 8 months. The main cause of this ministerial instability was the lack of disciplined parties. Constitutional life under the Fourth Republic, from 46 to 58, came to resemble that under the Third Republic, and the average lifespan of the government was shorter than in that Third Republic. Now, you may find somebody that comes along and says, well, shucks, I don't believe that that's France. Well, those French people came from someplace, and they fit that biblical prophecy. Now, he goes through all 12 tribes here, and he identifies the location for these 12 tribes and what happened to these people. Zebulun shall be at the haven of the sea and shall be for a haven of ships, and his border shall be unto Zidon. The Dutch port of Rotterdam has become the busiest seaport in the world. The Encyclopedia Americana states concerning Rotterdam, its port in volume of freight handled is the largest in the world. In addition to foreign trade, the port handles the huge barge traffic that is carried on the Rhine River and associated waterways. The port now extends continuously from Rotterdam to the sea. At the mouth of the new waterway lies the great port complex of Europort, Gateway of Europe. Zebulun is located in Holland today. The tribe of Asher has now been completely subjugated. They were the South Africans, the white South Africans. They have now lost their nation. So he goes through and he identifies each and every one of them. I thought I'd point that out to you. When you hear somebody say that the 10 tribes of Israel are lost, it's a lying deception. And the people who are telling you that are the religious people, and the religious people know better. Know better. And if they don't know better, they should know better. So in law, we use the term, they knew or they should have known. About vaccinations. I have covered vaccinations over the years many, many times. And I'm looking at a book here called The Poison Needle. Now, this one you may never be able to find. They didn't put out very many of them to start with. There was only 10,000 published, 5,057, 5,059, and 500 in 1974. We got this from Health Research in Mokelumne Hill, California. It's spelled M-O-K-E-L-U-M-N-E. I don't know if you'd ever find another one of these. I've often said I need to photocopy this, cut it out, paste it up, and put this thing back in print. Maybe I'll do that one of these days, but I haven't done it yet. But let me give you a couple, three excerpts out of this, because we're told constantly that vaccination is the solution to bad health. Vaccination will protect us from disease. If we just had a vaccine for AIDS, herpes, or VD, it would solve all of our problems. Now, the truth of the matter is the people that promote vaccination, primarily the medical establishment, the pharmaceutical companies in particular, are lying deceivers. They know that vaccines don't work. They know that they're dangerous and kill people. The reason that you and I don't rise up in holy righteous indignation against vaccines and vaccination is because they don't kill very many people. They kill a bunch. But in general, you know, you're vaccinating about 50 million children a year. And these 50 million children a year get 35 vaccines. And they're not dying like flies. It only kills about 100 a year. It harms or hurts a bunch more. Now, the one old doctor back in 1909, he said this. He said, in his medical practice, he had never seen a case of cancer in an unvaccinated person. Well, boys and girls, I'll bet you today that you could look high and low and you won't find a case of cancer in an unvaccinated person. Nearly everybody is vaccinated, and 50% of us are going to get cancer in our lifetime. Now, do vaccines cause cancer? I wouldn't go that far, but do they prevent cancer? No. Oh, that's certainly not true. Now, they're not claiming that they got a vaccine for cancer, but I don't have cancer yet. I got cancer once, that's skin cancer, and I haven't been vaccinated. So I can tell you that there's one unvaccinated person here who did get cancer once. But I'll bet you that it's pretty unusual, just like autism. I'll just bet you that if you checked unvaccinated people around the world, there might be a case of autism, but I'll bet you it'd be darn rare. Now, statements of health officials regarding vaccinated smallpox. Sir Thomas Chambers recorded of the City of London, he said this, I find that of the 155 persons admitted to the smallpox hospital in the parish of St. James, Piccadilly, 145 had been vaccinated. That's 94%. In Mellivore Hospital, 92% of the smallpox cases had been vaccinated. Marson's report of Highgate Hospital for 1871 states that of the 950 cases of smallpox, 870, 90% of the whole number of patients had been vaccinated. At Hempstead Hospital, up to May 13, 1884, out of 2965 admissions for smallpox, 2347 had been vaccinated, 79%. Boys and girls, clear back in the 1870s, we knew that vaccination didn't work. Now it's profitable. It makes a lot of money. And if we took you in and vaccinated you for flu, it probably wouldn't kill you. Probably. But here's what we find, that if you have had, I think it's two out of the last 10 years, but certainly five. If you've had five vaccinations out of the last 10 years for flu, your chances of getting Alzheimer's disease goes up, I think it's 50%, something like that. Now, I would say that's a statistic that should have some looking into, don't you? But who's telling you that? See, you know, it's out there, it's available, and you can pull it off the internet. But the average Joe Sixpack doesn't see that. What he sees, what he believes, is what he hears in public school. It's what mom and dad tell him. It's what the teacher tells him. It's what he hears from the army, you know, the military. They want to vaccinate everybody. To find somebody that's unvaccinated is going to be rare. It's not unheard of. It's just rare. There are people in the United States that don't vaccinate their children. In fact, it's quite a bunch of people. It's 12%. That's about 36 million people out of 300 million people in the country. 12%, 36 million, aren't vaccinated. You probably haven't run into very many of those people, but they're out there. So I thought I would bring that to your attention. Vaccination is a lying deception, which is brought about by lying deceivers. Now, here's the crazy part. The people that are selling these vaccines and these vaccinations, they know that. They're not ignorant. In fact, to give you an illustration, the guy by the name of Mendelssohn, he was a doctor. Robert Mendelssohn was a doctor. He taught in the university. He wasn't just a doctor. He was a teaching doctor. He was a college professor teaching medicine to the upcoming doctors. And he said that vaccinations don't work. And on top of that, he said, I wouldn't vaccinate a child because of the potential danger. Not that it kills every kid or 10% of them. It only kills 100 a year that we know about. But he said 90% of pediatricians do not vaccinate their own children. Now that's vital. Think of that. 90% of the pediatricians out there. Now this guy was a pediatrician. He is a health professional. He is a medical doctor. He teaches in the university. He teaches doctors. And he says, I wouldn't vaccinate my kids. I don't vaccinate children when I was practicing. And 90% of pediatricians do not vaccinate their own children. Now, if 90% of the pediatricians aren't vaccinating their own children, why are they vaccinating your child? They obviously don't believe in vaccination for their children. Why do they believe in vaccination for your child? Well, because they're getting paid $25 to give your kid the vaccine. Now, here's another little statistic. Every year in the United States, we vaccinate about 50 million children for polio. But there's only well, last time I saw a number, an average of 79 polio cases that come up every year. And every one of those 79 polio cases that come up comes up in a vaccinated person. Every one of the polio cases in the United States today is caused by the vaccine. And they tell us, well, that's a small price to pay for the protection that you receive. Now, does that make sense to you? Now, it is true we're going to give out 50 million polio vaccinations. Let's try 50 million times $25. That's $1.25 billion. That's $1.25 billion a year giving out polio vaccine. About 100 of those are going to come down with polio, about a 50 million, 100. It's actually less than that, but we'll just round it off to 100. That's not very many. But as Dr. Mendelsohn pointed out, he said, you could eliminate polio in the country by stopping the polio vaccine. But we're not going to do that because it would cost us $1.25 billion a year. And we can treat those 100 kids that get polio. You know, 100 of them would only be $100 million if you paid them $1 million each. Which means then that we would still make $1.150 billion profit, even if we paid all of the polio victims $1 million each. Can you see where money comes into this game? Now, if you have your kid shot up for polio, it probably isn't going to kill him. Probably. But it's going to cost you $25, and it isn't going to do him any good, and it's a lying deception. It is not going to protect him from polio. Polio has been eradicated, all right, but it was eradicated through other means other than vaccine. The vaccines did not eradicate polio. Health and hygiene did. But the myth is that polio vaccine did it, and they get the credit. But that's because that's what you were always told. You never saw the other side of the argument. So there's a book out here by Mendelsohn, and it's called How to Raise a Healthy Child in Spite of Your Pediatrician, Robert Mendelsohn. You can get a copy at your local health food store. Hey, I'm out of time again. Just when you're cranked up and having fun, you run out of time. You've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. And if you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has a radio log schedule and archives, and all of it can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Well, that's it. We're out of time. There's the signal says we've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.